Welcome to the episode 17 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education. And dangers of gene drive, we could do,
okay.
Or ARDF.
Maybe ARDF.
ARDF.
Okay. Should we start again?
No. This okay. is good.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast. You forgot to put Island CT in your notes.
So we're recording this on September 3rd. It is Thursday.
Wait, let me see something. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, I'm good. I had to adjust these microphones, headphones that we wear.
Yeah.
Tend to move if,
yeah.
you know.
I was trying to set mine
so,
up.
So, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So we're recording this podcast. Pardon me. We're recording this podcast on September 3rd. We don't have our blogs posted yet. Nope. We are still working on our setting up our web hosting.
Yeah, so maybe a bit of history here.
Okay.
We tried to get... I was going to be gone for a week during the podcast 17 setup, and we thought we'd record it early.
Right.
And we're pretty sure now that it's some Windows update screwed up the audio on your computer.
Right.
So Audacity wouldn't work anymore, and also Camtasia.
Camtasia, right. So I ended up with the NPR voice that they use when they don't want to identify the speaker.
Anyway, but you use that's what was pretty serious. You use Camtasia a lot for school.
Right, because we make podcasts for the students.
Or video casts.
Video casts stuff. For the students.
Yeah.
And
anyway, so we tried that.
Right.
And then we figured, well, maybe we'll do a Skype kind of thing over the network, and I just didn't have time to set any of that up. And
we were at a difference in our time schedule. You were 3 hours off of me.
Right.
So that also messed it up.
No, 2 hours only.
2 hours? Oh, yeah. I thought it was three. Okay.
No.
2 hours in the evening, so that really messed it up.
But, I mean, from the time I got there, it was really busy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
For good reason. Yeah. So we're
recording this 1 week late.
Right.
And then next week, we're going to record another one.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, we got a new computer for our server, but the DNS... .net or whatever is still down.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, but I think we might not go to that next. We might look for a web server. So we bought we might use a web hosting service. I think that makes the most sense.
Right.
And instead of running our own server, but we still want our own server for the backups and to test it at home.
Right.
Before we send it out. And that computer died that we were using to put it out on the internet. And we bought a new computer from Intrex, and I just put it to... Well, they put it together, and then I added some stuff, and I loaded up or installed Debian 8 on it for the first time last night.
Mm-hmm.
So we are making progress. It's not like we're standing still.
No.
But we still don't have anything out on the web since we've been down from when the server died.
Right.
Basically. Hopefully, this week coming up, we'll get the server going, and possibly the week after that, we'll have a web hosting site and be back up and running again.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So, yeah.
And basically, it's just getting back into a routine and... getting that web page up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would have stayed... Everything would have kept going if the server hadn't died. I mean, it's not like we've been off... Even though we've been off routine, we've still maintained doing the podcast, writing our blogs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite as good of a schedule as before, but we've kept up with it. So.
Yeah. No, I'm very happy that we have. Okay.
So that's all the administrative stuff.
Okay. What should we start with?
Up to you.
We could start with small stuff. I know that there's a lot of ARTIF that we would like to go over.
So that'd be mostly me.
Yep. Do you want to do that at the end?
No, we can do that now.
Okay, great. Okay, so tell us what you were doing last week.
Yeah, so I went to the... actually, I don't know if it's considered the U.S. or the Region 2 Championships. Region 2 is North America and South America combined. It's the Americas.
Oh, okay.
In Denver, Colorado. It was hosted by a local orienteering club, and the front person for that, who did a fantastic job organizing everything, was Brian Coleman. Really
nice.
good guy, with a lot of help from one of his other orienteers, Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And they really ran a really good show. And most of the technical stuff is handled by Marvin Johnston, mm-hmm. who does a lot of these ARDF competitions, and Joe Mole, who oversees a lot of stuff. And Joe Mole is actually the ARDF coordinator for the United States, I think.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
That's neat.
So
how many people show up to this, and where do they come from?
Oh, man, I wish I could remember. I think we had a total of over 80 people.
Nice.
But we had a humongous contingent of high school and younger Chinese, which came for the whole week.
Okay.
Well, actually, they missed the first day. But so there were three, let me see, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah, there were three practice days.
Mm-hmm.
And those were at slightly higher elevation, around 8,500 feet. And then there was the competition, starting with, let me see if I can remember. Sprint was first, then Foxering at the Peaceful Valley Scout Ranch, east of Denver, and southeast of Denver. And then the really big competitions, which are first the 2 meter and then the 80 meter, both of them the classic competitions.
Okay, so we should also back up. What is ARDIF?
So if you don't know what orienteering is, basically with orienteering you get a map, and sorry for those that have listened to the podcast and already know about this, but you get a map, and on the map there's a number of locations marked, and you use a compass and the map. Let me check my audio here, because this was really close. Okay. I think this is good. And you have to find locations marked on the map, and usually they have a particular assigned order, but in a lot of cases for ARDIF, that's not the case. Anyway, so that's orienteering. It's a competition. You go out in the woods, you find all the places, and there's a punch at each one, and you punch in, and then you come back to the start or wherever the finish is, and you're timed, and you know, shortest time wins. With ARDIF, generally speaking, you have a similar situation, except when you get your map, there's no position marked on it that you have to be at. Instead, you have a radio receiver that has the ability to tell you which direction a radio signal comes from. And you go out in the woods and you listen. And when you know when you figure out what direction a radio signal comes from, you go in that direction, you find the receiver, you punch in there. And then once you've found all the receivers you're supposed to, you go to the finish, and then, so it's similar, except you're using a receiver to find the controls, as they're called, control locations, rather than seeing them on the map.
Okay.
So that's the general, there's different types.
Okay, good.
So, yep. So,
So the length of the competition, is it about a 2.5 hour time that you have to go and get
I've been at some that were as long as 3 hours. In this case, the classic ones, the 2 meter band classic was 2.5 hours.
Okay.
And the 80 meter was 2 hours. So in other words, once you hit the start, you've got to be back for 80 meter, for example. You have to be back and punch finish before 2 hours.
Okay.
And I don't know, if you don't make it back on time, I think you just get disqualified.
Okay.
So, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's it. And, I mean, there's another couple types. There's foxering and a sprint event.
Okay.
And both of those I'd never done before.
So what's a foxering like?
Foxering is basically, imagine that you're doing an orienteering course.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a map, the controls are marked, you go out and you go find the controls, compass and map.
Mm-hmm.
But in a regular orienteering course, you arrive there and you have a flag. And you run up to the flag and that's where the punch is, and you punch in. And then you go on to the next one. With foxering, kind of the foxering type of ARDF, when you arrive at the control location, there's no flag there.
Mm-hmm.
But from the place where the flag would have been, you should be able to hear a very low power transmitter.
Okay.
You can't hear it from very far away.
Mm-hmm.
But if you find the correct place where a flag should have been, then you can, from that place, you should be able to hear the transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so you search locally in that very small area for the transmitter, which is only marked by a pole stuck in the ground and the punch on top of that. So there's
okay.
no flag. So it's a lot harder to see.
Mm-hmm. And when you say a pole, we're talking about less than an inch in diameter.
Yeah.
Okay. About,
yeah. 3/4 inch in diameter, mm-hmm. something like that. There's rules that think that they're supposed to have like a candy stripe wrapper around them or something.
Okay.
I don't know if they always do that or not.
Okay.
So that's foxering.
Okay. And this is a very fast.
Foxering.
Competition.
Was pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
It was shorter than the classic events.
Mm-hmm.
But not as fast running as the sprint.
Got it.
Yeah. So the sprint is very complicated if you're not used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, with the sprint, you have a bunch of transmitters to find on one frequency. You can hear them from far away, but they're close to each other.
Right.
So you are running quickly from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other reasons you go a lot faster. For example, on the classic courses, the transmitters are on for a whole minute.
Got
and
it.
They cycle through all the transmitters every 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
On the sprint, they're only on for 12 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So they're on and then suddenly they're off. But they come back every minute.
Right, yeah. Right. So it puts you under a bit of pressure to keep up with them.
So it's a lot, they're a lot closer together. And then after you find the first five, you switch to a different frequency, listen for a spectator beacon.
Mm-hmm.
And you go there, you punch in, and the spectator beacon is placed so that people just kind of hanging out can see all the competitors go by and hit it. And then you go out and you find still another frequency, another set of transmitters, and then you go to the finish.
So what's the biggest challenge in that part, in that type of competition?
For the sprint?
Mm-hmm. Is it like focus? Like just mental focus? Trying to keep up with all of it?
Let me see. Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Because if you're trying to write things down,
mm-hmm.
you will be way slow.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all happening too fast. So you have to keep it all in your head. And a typical example of a mistake which I made is I was running towards one transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to get there really fast because they were all close to each other.
Right.
And I kept hearing another transmitter just to my left,
mm-hmm.
right? And I knew I had to get that one next. But the far one, but the one I was going to was further. So it didn't make any sense to divert my course because I could get the other one on the way back, mm-hmm. right? Finally, I get to the far one. I punch it, I turn, and I run in the direction where I know my last one is,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I kept hearing it on the left. And I'm running and I'm running. And then I get confused. And in my head, the number of those two transmitters gets switched.
Oh.
And after running through the woods and stuff, okay, I need to listen to the right, for the right one. And I listen, mm-hmm. and I've been turned around a bit. And because in my head they're switched, I start to listen to the one I've just punched, thinking it's the one I'm going for.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically turn around, mm-hmm. right? But I've already been turned around a bit, going through woods and stuff. So I don't realize how badly this turn is. I just thought I was like at a 90 degree off, mm-hmm. because that, maybe I was close, right?
Right.
And then after a while, I realized I'm just going back for the one I've just punched. So mm-hmm. instantly I realized what's happening. I turn around. And so, yeah. So definitely, you're right. It's mentally keeping track of everything in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just, when we've done sprints for orienteering, I find them the most distracting of any of the events. And having a bunch of controls out with no particular direction to go, it makes it very difficult.
Yeah, so I think that's what they call, I'm not sure, but I think they call that SCORO,
mm-hmm.
where you don't have a particular order you have to go in.
Yeah.
And pretty much all ARDF events are SCORO style.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Although it was a little bit disappointing. The courses in Denver, they were set up, they were SCOROs, mm-hmm. technically. But when you looked at it, it made no sense. You know, you had one and then another. Well, actually, that's not true. For the sprint, that was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Foxering, this was mm-hmm. definitely the case. Because in a SCORO, you know, you have to choose which controls you're going to go for, because you're not going to get everything.
Right.
You know, unless you're really good, in which case you might. But even then, you've got to be really smart about which ones you get. You know, mm-hmm. the order, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, obviously you had a great time.
I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did much better on the 2 meters than I did last time.
Nice.
I'm sorry, this is my second real 2 meter event.
Yeah.
And we don't have a transmitter, so there's no way for us to practice here.
Right.
So we've gone out together for 80.
Mm-hmm.
So, but 2 meter. Yeah, I did a lot better than last time, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So, did you see some people out there that were just, like, incredible?
Yeah, the Ukrainians usually were pretty good. And I didn't realize a whole bunch of the Eastern Europeans that we have, so a lot of them that are living in the United States, are actually from Moldova.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and quite a few from there. Chinese did well.
Mm-hmm.
They have the numbers.
Yeah.
They're fun to see running on the woods because so many of them are so young.
Right. So the Chinese group was mainly a group of students.
Yeah. There were some, the coaches definitely ran, which mm-hmm. is important, but mostly they were students, mm-hmm. high school and younger.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Let me see. I took some notes over here. Let me see if there was anything important I wanted to. Oh, the altitude.
Yeah.
So I've never been this high for exercise. When I arrived in Denver that evening, I had a big headache.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's related or not, but in theory it should be.
Yeah.
And I took ibuprofen and then I was fine. I was able to run.
Wow.
From the very first day.
That's
I'm
good.
Sure I was slower, but
mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to run, but you know, with the excitement of the, I mean, those were practice competitions on the first day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. I saw pronghorn.
Yeah.
Antelope. I mean, mm-hmm. they're not really antelope, but That was really interesting, seeing the different gates, especially the one that looks like a kangaroo.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool.
Neat.
And met a lot of people that are getting... So this is really important for both of us, mm-hmm. especially you, but trying to get the makerspace and art of going... there's a pronghorn.
Yeah, right, I just thought, yep. I'll pull up the image because I wasn't quite sure what they look like.
That's exactly what they look like.
And you say they bounce like kangaroos sometimes?
Well, I looked up and according to Wikipedia, I think they have like 13 different gates. I saw them walking around like when I came up to them and they were close to a control. So that happened once. And I saw them in the distance with that kangaroo-like mm-hmm. gate. Which is really cool to see. And supposedly they're the fastest land animal in the Americas.
Neat.
And second fastest in the world after the cheetahs.
So, very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
But yeah, the other thing, I met quite several people that were into either orienteering or art of,
mm-hmm.
well, either directly in orienteering, Mike Shu, he's over by the Cascades, he's doing orienteering, and he has a whole high school league that he's involved with,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool.
That is neat.
But two people that I've gotten that have plans for art of, a lady that's working in the Denver schools, Cindy Powell, and she's already started.
Nice.
And she's going to do 2 meters with high schoolers.
Good.
And...
I thought 2 meters would be more challenging to set up.
Yeah, well, it depends how you look at it.
Okay.
And that's what she chose. You know, it's different if you get your equipment
versus... I'm asking, it's nothing that I have any kind of insight about.
Yeah. And then the other person was David Gent.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave is working, he's taken over the directorship, or I don't know what you call it, of a amateur radio club at Texas A&M.
Oh, neat.
And he's got interested in doing some art of with them. So two totally different people, and sent emails off to them and to you, of course.
Yeah.
Haven't heard anything back from them. But, I mean, we don't have anything to share yet. We're all just starting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really encouraging to see that hopefully within a year we're going to have all different kids, especially the high school and the middle school, getting into this.
And getting excited about it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to get enough equipment here put together that we can run a really small meet for the middle school. So.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. So that's all I had
for
RDF. I mean, I have a lot more, but I think... This is good for
now. I think some more will come out in other podcasts, especially as we start to set up for things around here and get out to practice.
So the enrichment club doesn't happen until the spring, right?
Yeah, until the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, see, now I'm so excited. I'm like, maybe we can get something going with the kids before the winter, but it comes, but mm-hmm. I don't know. Might be difficult.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although you might be able to do something really small just over the lunchtime.
With the group of students that come to the makerspace.
You could bring just a couple of the Chinese receivers and put up just an antenna. See, the idea would be that when the spring comes, you have several students that just outside of your class, just in that little quad area or something, have mm-hmm. actually fooled around with the receivers and understand, oh, that's how I find the null, that's how I do the direction, mm-hmm. you know. So that then the next step is just going to find it where it's far, you know. I don't know. I really want to help,
mm-hmm.
but it'll be difficult for that part.
Well, and we'll see what we can manage with it. I'm hoping the enrichment is at the end of the day, and probably we'll get a few snow days in there to make them on Saturdays, unfortunately. As long as they don't add to the end of the school year, I'm good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, move on. You have some stuff?
Yeah, I have a few things. I figured I would go over a few of my little things, and then we could go back to that topic that we were talking about earlier with CRISPR.
CRISPR gene okay. drives.
Yeah. So I've been enjoying just these articles about Native peoples.
Yeah.
And also the archaeologists and their articles when they talk about early peoples in Europe and that, and they're trying to put together, you know, just an idea of what it was like. And I found this one news article in Science where they talk about a mass grave that was found in Germany, and it's like it's from
I heard about that. This is the shin bones one.
Yeah. And
I mean, that's just a detail, but
right, so it's about 7,000 years ago.
7,000, so that's like the start of agriculture in the
right
Netherlands.
So part of the idea of early agriculture is it was very peaceful and there wasn't much warring in between groups,
right.
And that. And then they found this mass grave of 26 individuals, and many of them are children. And when they started excavating the grave, they found that very strange that, you know, of course, all of them were killed, but then afterwards the bodies were mutilated, so their shin bones were all broken. And the kind of strange thing is it didn't seem to matter the age. So adult, from 6 months to adult, all had their shins broken.
Yeah.
And so they were saying that, well, maybe it comes with a belief that it stops their ghosts from following them and bringing bad spirits to them,
right,
because they won't be able to walk in the spirit world. So there's things like that. They're still trying to figure out what happened.
Just the fact that this appears to have been a farming area.
Yeah.
And then you find this mass grave with obviously some kind of ritualistic damage done to the bodies and execution style stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of, who wrote The Third Chimpanzee? And
oh, yes. Oh, dear.
Can't believe you don't remember.
I can't believe it. I feel like going out and grabbing the book. I think we have the book in our bookshelf.
He's at a university in California,
oh,
I think.
What am I doing? We have the internet back. Here we go.
Anyway, he went and lived in, I don't know if it's Borneo or, you know, one of these islands close to the South Seas, and studied the tribes down there. Jared Diamond.
Yeah, Jared Diamond.
Yeah. So he lived down there, and he says that, you know, warfare between the tribes is just incredibly violent, and you go through these repeated massacres within between periods of peace where tribes expand into areas where other people have been massacred.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of sounds like that type of thing. Maybe that's the type of animal we were, that, you know, we live through these peaceful times, but we go on these rampages to destroy neighboring peoples because of pressure to, you know,
right, and
need for land and stuff.
So I guess that's part of the question that the archaeologists are facing, is like, what were the early peoples like? And this is the second mass grave that they found with a ritualistic.
So where was this?
Killings. So this was in
Europe.
This was in Europe. And so it probably is more where, let's see.
But how close to the Levant was it?
So
is it in Germany or?
It's.
Was it closer?
I thought they said modern Turkey.
Turkey?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So
probably over in Anatolia somewhere. That's pretty close to the Levant. I mean, there was agriculture there very early.
So that's what they're trying to figure out, you know, how this works into early peoples and how they interacted with their neighboring villages.
Right.
Yeah. So very interesting. It's just one of those that kind of make you think about it. I like the article a lot. I think that the person that wrote it actually went out on a limb when they started to connect it to the modern day, you know, problems.
Yeah.
And so that one, I don't know. I think when there's a finding about a very specific group in a very specific time period, it's not to make these large, encompassing.
I also love the comparisons of humans in those times, as much as we can tell, which we're trying to figure out in modern day behaviors of chimpanzees versus bonobos.
Yeah.
You know, we all share so much DNA, and yet patterns, I mean, you could even say cultural, even for the chimpanzees, of behavior seem to be so different in the two, bonobos versus chimps, you know? Or, I guess bonobos are pygmy chimps also, is that the name?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Anyway.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what an isolated population of chimpanzees exposed to a different type of lifestyle.
Yeah.
Well, exposed. If they're isolated, they're not exposed at the point. But,
right.
But you know what I'm saying? You know, would they automatically have to become violent and go on these raids killing others? Or is that something that is learned, you know,
right,
for generations?
Right. And is there a need, you know, for territory or resources that, you know, maybe not is so obvious to the people looking from the outside. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I was reading about, it's an article on the Mashco-Piro tribes emerging from isolation in Peru. And it was...
you wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Before I left for Colorado.
Yes. And so...
I remember having read about that.
Yeah. It's like they have these very isolated
groups. Is that the one where you can see them on the banks of the river?
Yes.
Okay. I'm only going to faintly remember because this is 2 weeks ago now.
So we have these really isolated groups. And because they're starting to be seen on banks of rivers and that, people are making these casual contacts with them.
Right.
And,
but I think they're being seen because they want, they're anticipating the contact and they want it.
Right. So they're starting to look for that contact.
Yeah.
But the problem is that this is a very isolated group that has not been exposed to all the stuff that our immune systems have been built up from childhood, you know.
I mean, there's danger both ways.
There is.
There's for them. They don't realize it.
Right.
But I'm sure in certain situations they would be ready to do violence for the purpose of getting stuff, you know.
Right. So there's a real fear for the group and what those contacts will bring.
Yeah, because they have no idea how devastating it can be.
Right. And so there's, you know, this ongoing conversation between the researchers that are working in those areas and then the government, you know, and what they're going to do. But you also have a group of people in a really remote area. And what can the government do to kind of maintain isolation of those groups?
Right.
And so, and of course you have missionaries and people coming in contact with them as they move down the river. And unfortunately, there's things like tour groups doing the human safari tours, right. Which is, you know, so sad that we can't appreciate, you know, the need to maybe just not go.
Right. But, I mean, that's a serious need for us to just stay away.
Right. And I think when I read the article, I'm like, you know, I think sometimes we just can't appreciate the benefit it would have for us just to appreciate, you know, a group like that at a distance. Yeah.
And to a certain extent, you have to think, you know, the people in government, I mean, you know, they have jobs. A lot of them, I'm sure, were not expecting to deal with a situation like this.
Right.
And every organization around the world, which probably rightfully understands the way this should be done, is going to be critical of them for whatever they decide to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember I don't remember what's their plan was for how to deal with the people.
They haven't really. Like,
they were wanting to keep them isolated.
They want to keep them isolated, and they think that's the best situation.
Yeah.
But the government has reacted too late. Contact has been started. We have a tour, you know, tour groups coming through.
Yeah.
And it's just...
Are they sending people to contact the tribe? Do you remember?
They were. I thought they were sending people to contact the tribe.
Because once contact is initiated, you want
them... And they want to assist them in just, like... Making
and not dying,
right? Making the contact safe for them,
you're right,
and making sure they have the materials that they need to maintain themselves.
That's a bad situation.
It is. So it's one of those that when I read about, it's such a challenging situation.
I remember the picture of the people sitting on the bank from that tribe, and it was just kind of neat.
Yeah. Yeah. So those were the two articles that kind of stood out to me last week. And very interesting. The other topic that we both looked up when we were away from each other, so that was kind of neat that we both came to it. We had two different articles, and I left my articles aside and went to your article because I figured in the time that I had, your article was it was easier to go through. And
what was my article?
Yours was looking at...
was that the safeguarding gene drive?
The safeguarding, the gene drive, and thinking about how research using mechanisms like CRISPR-Cas9, how it can be implemented safely, or at least, you know, regulated in a way.
My instinct was that this is a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
When I looked at that, I'm like, oh yeah, I can see how this could be pretty scary.
And...
So maybe you want to explain what you found?
Okay.
Because you got further into it than I did.
Well...
I only got to, like, here.
Sort of. I started to, you know, skim more because I thought I was catching up to you. So I thought you had read the whole article.
Only read like two columns. And then, so when I knew you got interested and I knew the podcast we had to do today because we're late,
it's just that time.
There was one, here, move off the page a bit. Okay, there was one section right in here when it said, blah, 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 blah. Okay.
Additional
blah, 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 use, no. that these, okay, I'm quoting, that these studies documented highly efficient RNA-guided gene drive in flies and yeast underscores the potential of the technology and the risk resulting from an accidental release. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, two of the groups that put together this article, because this is a humongous group. Five authors on the first line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines of authors. Mm-hmm. So that's like 30 authors.
Right.
Rough estimate. But two of the groups they'd mentioned earlier in the article, they demonstrated the use of CRISPR-Cas9 as a gene drive. One group, I think, in Drosophila melanogaster, and the other one in Cerevisiae, the yeast. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, so you're going to look at the article. So I'm going to look at those, right? What was the original research? And I started to look up one of those, and mm-hmm. but I had so much work to do on our new server and stuff.
Right,
and
right.
I didn't get very far. So that's what I went to instead. I never got to the Drosophila one.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know, maybe you want to go over your take on the what the big deal is?
Okay, so that's actually where I thought you would come in, because you seem to have a better...
Why I had this reaction?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just having this reaction in relation to all this just freaky scariness of GMO crops. I mean, that's the way I take it. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And it's not that there's not stuff that's really bad about genetically modified crops, but it just seems to me like all the stuff that you see out there in the popular media is absolutely ridiculous. It's just fear because of they don't understand, they don't know, mm-hmm. they don't want to know. There's some serious issues about reducing genetic diversity and,
right.
you know, but I mean, it's like, you know, those are things that take a long time to happen, and there's stuff that we can do about it, although the reason we're not going to, probably societal pressures. The CRISPR-Cas9 as a gene drive system seemed to me like a risk of something really bad that could happen by a single kind of event. Boom, it
right.
happened. Oh, crap. What are we going to do about it? And the reason is this. You modify an organism,
mm-hmm.
and you release it in the wild.
Right.
And you modified it in some way, and it's got some characteristic that's really bad, right? That's the fear, and it mm-hmm. gets released. Well, it's going to breed with the wild population.
Right, right.
And if you modified it, its fitness is going to be lower.
Mm-hmm.
That's the expectation. That's the finding almost every time. So it's going to have to deal with Mendelian genetics mm-hmm. as it breeds with a population that doesn't have your mutation, right?
Right.
So let's say you bred this homozygous individual, he gets out there, he escapes mm-hmm. your lab, next generation of the ones that
right.
you bred breeds with the wild, and because he was homozygous, then all of the children, well, one of them is, I'm looking at the chart you have up, this doesn't make sense, but well, this would be if it's
right.
I don't know, but the first generation you ferry should carry one of the genes of yours and one of the wild,
mm-hmm.
and so none of the first generation should show your effect
right.
if it's recessive. Right? Mm-hmm. If it's dominant, then they should all show it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
If yours is homozygous, right? It looks like the way in your chart is actually ahead of zygote.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and then
I'll read down.
The one after that instead of having half the genes, it's got 1/8 of genes and 1/16 every generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the Mendelian genetics. Plus, on top of that, you've got this reduced fitness so that yours are going to have a poor reproductive success, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you release something bad in the wild, but really, what's the problem? Okay. With gene drive systems, the goal is to overcome Mendelian genetics.
Right.
And the way it's been done is systems, the way I understand it, with my not very good understanding, is that in a cell, if you have a heterozygote, the genes will be transcribed and they will look for the sequence on the opposite chromosome.
Right.
Remove that one and replace it with their own. And so now every heterozygote turns itself into a homozygote.
Right.
Before the next breeding.
And that's really hard to visualize what's happening, you know, that the power of that.
Yeah. Well, and then now you put CRISPR, so that's really tough to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you add CRISPR-Cas9, which has become really easy for pretty much any molecular genetics lab to do,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly you can make these gene drive systems with very little experience, you know, or very little work by comparison, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so, I mean, I was telling you a little while ago, you know, we do experiments all the time. The point is not even to do anything beneficial. It's because we don't understand yet how to do something beneficial. We're just trying to figure out what's happening in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you provide, and you do an experiment just to figure things out.
Right.
And some of the things you do might, if they got released, be really dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I was actually going on the tangent of the yeast and the changes that they can make in yeast now, and how that could really be an awesome, wonderful thing, or a crazy, you know, thing that could get out of control, like if it goes the narcotic route and that.
That's a totally different issue.
Where my mind went when I was thinking about it too. And the reason is because in one of the science magazines currently they talk about warehousing yeast, and I didn't get through the whole article, but it, you know, with the stuff of
but that had nothing to do with CRISPR or Cas9, did it?
No, it didn't. Okay. But I was like, you know, there's potential there.
Yeah, you're bringing in a totally different topic here. You're talking about the people that modified the yeast genome to get production of opiates.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, which, of course, makes it
so a lot I'm just like, you have this great mechanism that works, and
that's not a gene drive issue, though. It's a, I guess that's a CRISPR-Cas9. I don't know.
And that was going to be my question for you.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember if they use CRISPR for that.
Okay.
They might have.
Anyway, I'll be looking into that so we can come back to it next week if it comes up.
Yeah.
But fascinating stuff.
I mean, you're the one who got me into the gene drive systems because of your work with Dr. Gould.
Yeah.
And I'd never even studied any of this type of stuff. And since, was it last summer?
Yes.
You did the work with him? I'd started to read up on gene drive systems, and it's a whole new area that I hadn't really thought about. And you know, how do you overcome Mendelian genetics?
Right. And I do like some of their confinement strategies.
Yeah.
I thought they were really good.
What did they have?
One of them that I thought was really good was that when you're performing experiments out, like, you know, on an organism, you keep them outside the range that they can live.
Right,
and that, like, you know, it should be a no-brainer, but I hadn't really thought about, you know, a controlment system.
I've got the table up here.
Mm-hmm, so do I.
You're talking about the, like, Anopheles work
right.
in Boston.
Right.
Where
the ecological.
If they get out, they can't right. live outside your lab anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love that idea. It's simple, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it controls a lot of situations where, you know, if it did get out, it, you never want them to get out, but if it did, it's not going to live long.
Right, right.
And I also liked the, like, I think you were mentioning it today, that there's some kind of requirement, molecular requirement, that you give the organism in the lab, but it will not be administered in the wild, so that they wouldn't have that ability to.
Yeah. So one of the, I think one of the those as an example,
mm-hmm.
Well, the one that I remember is not so much one. You know, you can make organisms that could only live in the lab because you give them something, and if they don't have it, they die. But the one that they mentioned that I remember was the idea that, you know, CRISPR will go in and will remove sequences and replace them with itself.
Right.
Right. And so what you do is, before you use CRISPR, you create an organism that has sequences that you totally just made up.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't even exist in the wild.
Right.
So then you try to do your CRISPR experiments with CRISPR targeting those sequences.
Got it.
And so if it ever, your organism ever gets released,
mm-hmm.
then CRISPR goes looking for it, for those mm-hmm. sequences to copy itself, and they don't exist because you
right.
made them up.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of an interesting.
I like that.
Yeah.
And then,
because I mean, if people don't understand, you know, how does do these enzymes recognize stuff? I mean, the original work with yeast was, you know, the proteins recognize it. So how do you
right.
make it pick? And what makes CRISPR so fantastic is that the enzyme doesn't recognize anything. It's got a short piece of RNA, and the RNA sequence binds to CRISPR and Cas9, I guess, or whatever. I don't totally remember the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And then the RNA matches up to the DNA, and when it matches, then your protein, your enzymes go to work on that DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So you only need to change the RNA
right.
to get CRISPR-Cas9 to start chewing on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, of course, I mean, it's easy for us to design a sequence of RNA bases and to whatever we want. And
mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So.
But you remember there was there was another big issue associated with CRISPR and Cas9 having to do with the fear of it used on human embryos. Remember that?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And one of the issues there was, can't remember what I was going to say. Oops. It's escaped me.
Oh.
Anyway. Oh, yeah, yeah. The fear was that, yeah, so, I mean, it works fantastic in the lab because we pick, you know, those organisms that make it through the process. But they've done it. I think it was the Chinese, one of the Chinese
right.
had done it. On
non-viable zygotes.
Non-viable zygotes. Yes, exactly. And what they found is a humongous number of off-target effects. In other words, mm-hmm. DNA sequences that had been attacked by CRISPR-Cas9 that didn't match the RNA they'd used.
Right, right.
So, you know?
I know.
It's like, well, yeah, you can get the results you want, but you've got this huge population that's totally unrelated that just got screwed up.
Right.
And who knows where.
Exactly.
So, anyway.
Yeah. So it's very.
Especially when you're talking about gene drives, you're not talking about, you know, the Chinese group had used like 80-some with a huge effort. I'm talking about gene drives. You're talking about millions of
right.
individuals.
Right.
I assume.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I mean, mosquitoes, at least, you're talking.
So, I find this topic fascinating, and I think it's going to be an ongoing topic where we're going to get.
I'd love to hear what Gould.
I would too. I'll have to ask him. I'll have to email him and see what he thinks about it. Because I do find it fascinating, just to see.
I mean, it seems to me like a real serious concern.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that that's going to be coming up again and again in the future for how to deal.
Doesn't that make you wonder what other thing that CRISPR-Cas9 is going to be applied to next?
Yeah, that's why I said the yeast. It's not that I know what's being done in yeast, but I just thought with the whole thing about, you know, the yeast being worked on right now, that it might be something that would be used.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
By the way, the yeast article is not even in print yet. It was on the BioArchive preprint server.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still going through revisions and stuff.
So to keep ahead of Patrick, I try to go over to the news and catch things right before they're published out so I can say, oh, I knew that. I'm teasing. Okay. Well, I think it is time to wrap up because we're going to be back right next week.
Yeah, I think we've only been 56 minutes, but
right,
that's a good...
I think that's good because we had a shorter podcast this time.
Yeah.
And since we're going to have one soon...
Yeah, which will be short again.
It will be short. But very
future
excited
plans
about getting a web hosting service.
Yeah.
You know, I am.
Probably won't get done by the next podcast.
It probably won't, but I think that I'm going to make some headway this weekend. We have a long weekend. Woohoo!
Right. Yep.
And so I'm hoping to do something then. So thank you for listening.
The future plans.
Oh, future plans. Oh, dear.
You have it on your thing there.
Yep. So I started the school year. Yep. And I started the Makerspace the second week of school.
I know, that is really cool.
And you know, I thought,
you're kind of pushed.
Should I do that? But I had one of the kids ask me.
Yeah.
And then I looked around the cafeteria last week, first week of school, and we have a lot of new students, and we have all of these. Well, we have about 5 students that haven't found a place to sit at lunch.
Uh-huh.
So they need to be in smaller groups to make friend connections so they'll have people to sit with. So I was like, you know, I'm just going to gather those kids together and I'll just do a makerspace this week. It'll be small.
What do you guys work on?
I put out the Makey Makeys. No one knew what they were.
That's the good place to start.
And I figure it gives them something to play with someone. They can talk about it and it's more social. So I pulled them in and apparently word got out that it was good. Uh-huh. I've had 5 kids come up to me asking me if they could go next week.
Cool.
Which is really funny because I didn't expect that kind of response. I invited, you know, you have to be careful as a teacher who you invite.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea that the face that you get from a child or a student may not be anything close to what you think it might be. So imagine I run into the cafeteria to grab 2 new students that just arrived that day. I'm like, they won't have any friends. I'll grab them, bring them back to my room. They can go to the makerspace with the other kids. And the kids were like, yeah, I'd like to come. So they came back with me. And as I'm taking them, this one of my other students who doesn't talk to me much in class and has made fun of me several times in front of kids, you know, which I think is a hoot, but at the same time, it's like, what?
Yeah.
And I'm taking them away and he goes, where are you going? I go, well, I'm doing a makerspace today. Do you want to come? And he gives me this face. And I thought it was like, you've got to be kidding, right, face?
Right.
So he goes, I go, you're more than welcome. Love to have you. I'm in 5'10", so just come down. And He literally turned away without a word and walked away. And I thought, okay, he's not coming. And so I grabbed the other two and take them down. He brought five of his friends.
I know, that's
so
that's crazy.
And they were all these, like, you know, kind of, you know, more athletic guys.
Yeah.
So they were athletic guys and music guys. So I had this kind of crazy group. And one of them knew how to do the makey makey because he had done it before but forgot.
Cool.
And he was supposed to show the other ones, and that's why they came, because he was going to show them, not Miss Sears.
Oh, that's fun.
Which is awesome. Yeah, you know, I love that. And so I had two computers. I just threw them out. I'm like, okay, Johnny, go for it.
That's great.
And they got them going, and they all want to come back this week.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that was just...
Do you have another Makey Makey coming up?
I did.
I mean, not another Makerspace lunchtime.
I told them I'd do it every Tuesday now.
Every Tuesday?
Yeah. Okay. And the student that I promised to start by at least the third week of school missed it, because when I talked to the other science teacher, I told her I was trying to get my lost souls, people who hadn't found a friend base. And so she was picking students like that,
and the one that wanted
to go never got asked, because he's a really outgoing kid,
right.
And he's excited. He wants to work on Raspberry Pis. He wants to get the camera going or something like that.
Yeah, we need some help with that camera.
We do. I'm wondering if it's broken. I just need to replace it, but I'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a possibility.
Well, I'm like, you know...
I don't remember exactly.
I don't remember how kids used
it. We talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah. So I'll...
But I don't remember exactly what the issue was. And
I can... Actually, I can even send it home with Michael in a little box with a pie. And I know it's going to come back because I know his whole family. So they can test it at home because I know...
How much are those cameras?
$20. Yeah.
Might be worth getting another.
That's what I think I'll do. Mm-hmm. I'll tell Michael that I'm going to get another if it doesn't work, but I need to
test it. We could also test it here before anybody gets their hands on it.
Try to make sure it works here.
No, I mean, some of those kids are just as good as we are, and some of them are less careful, but the point is that now that we know there's possibly an issue, the very first time we take it out of the package and stuff, try to do everything exactly, precisely. So, why are you laughing?
Okay, one last thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so Carr came back to pack up Isaac's computer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But she didn't just pack his computer. She had to take his pie and his Makey Makey.
Oh, that's funny.
I love it. So this is our older son who is just dying to get back into computers and electronics. And it's just, it's fun to see.
He's still at Fort Benning?
He's at Fort Benning.
So.
Mm-hmm. But now he has it all with him, so he can mess around with it whenever
he wants. I didn't realize
he
didn't have all his stuff.
I didn't know either. I would have mailed it to him.
Yeah.
But he was being polite.
So does he have the, so that means he probably now has the FPGA board, the Mojo.
Yeah. He has some Mojo. Mojo's a little too much. He needed to mess around with smaller things.
With something
things.
Small stuff. But you'd be surprised how fast he might get up on it, you know.
Yeah. I think he'll get bored with the small stuff and move on to the other. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny, the Makey Makey stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, doing the sound stuff, especially with the Read2Me program stuff, I found that boring very quickly. But the concept of having a very easy way to input stuff through USB directly into the operating system's reading of keyboard and mouse is very powerful.
Yep.
To design your own electronics that then interface with a program that you already have on the computer.
Right.
You know, I don't have the time right now to do that, but that's something that I would have really liked to do. And I mean, that's definitely in the plans. So
you'll like my Makey Makey group if they all come back. They're like this crazy group, and one of them, he is.
Did you have the Raspberry Pis up at the last?
I didn't.
Not yet.
I didn't put them out
but
at all.
It's good to bring it out incrementally. Yeah. Keeps the excitement up. And
yeah. Basically, I put the Makey Makeys out because I had the boxes ready. I just had to throw Play-Doh in with them, set them up quickly, and get them going.
That is the easiest thing to just get started by far.
And I can pull out something different next week.
Yeah.
Like I was going to bring out those little circuitry boxes. They're like Lego circuitry.
Those connect
little bits.
Things, yeah. Mm-hmm. The little bits system. That's its name.
Yeah. Right. I would like the kids to make their own. I think that would be too cool. And I think it'd be easy. And I've seen little YouTube videos about it.
Remember, when we changed the name of the podcast and the whole system to Island CT, one of the ideas was to have these little simple projects for kids that show up at the makerspace, don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple, described, you know, projects that are short, put it together in like 10 minutes to a half hour or so and get something simple working. And breadboarding stuff, I mean, that's a typical type thing.
So we're putting together that in the next little while.
Yep.
And when we get our website, maybe that's something that people can share with us, you know, cool projects that they've done and that they've worked together under, you know, 20 minutes, because the kids usually have about 20 to 30 minutes to work through a lunch after they eat.
I think as a start, it'll be us putting out what we've done.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because that we've started already. I mean, I've started those small projects.
I just wouldn't want anyone to think that we wouldn't be open to new ideas.
No.
We would love that.
It's a little bit more complicated, though. I mean,
yeah.
So one reason I like the idea of the web hosting site is that, I can design a web page, fine. We can work at it together, put images and stuff, put up our blogs. But then when it comes to things that are like forums and stuff where people respond and comment, I just don't, I'm not interested.
No.
It'd be an interesting thing to keep control of and to do the code for if there was like an unlimited amount of time. But, I want to work on science. I don't want to work on coding stuff. And,
and that's why it would be more of a sharing community where you could, hey, look at this.
Well, we need a web hosting site and figure out how it works. What they offer in terms of that type of stuff.
Yep, definitely. So
those are the plans.
Those are the future plans.
Yeah. And new orienteering set up by David Waller at Carolina North Forest right by your school.
Nice. I'm very excited.
It's amazing that he's had this idea, and we've actually done, well, it wasn't last year because we skipped last year, but the year before. Orienteering for the Smith Middle School Enrichment Club.
Right, right.
So, and I think this year we're going to end up doing the ARDF instead.
Yeah, yeah.
But, it's the same thing, right? As far as it's just even more for the kids.
Right.
So, cool stuff.
Okay.
So I think we've gone on and on talking about future plans and what we've just, or what you've done with the, so I think we're good for that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's wrap this up. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.